Mesdames, Messieurs, chers et chers collègues, bienvenue au Collège de France pour ce colloque en anglais, Consenting to International Law. I will now switch to English. I'll save all of those who were panicking, thinking this conference will actually be taking place in French. No, it will be taking place in English. So, welcome to all of you at the Collège de France for our conference, Consenting to International Law. The seemingly peaceful look of divisio in the allegory of the bad government by Lorenzetti in Siena is absolutely deceptive. With her saw, divisio is slowly but surely and entirely painlessly dividing the city, the civic body, in two, as you can see from the si and the no on her robe. The allegory reminds us how divided our world is, and by extension, the international community of states and peoples. It also reminds us of the formidable and much more painful challenge we face every day to address common concerns, be it climate change, pandemics, or war. The challenge of adopting law in circumstances of persistent disagreement is actually made even greater at the international level because of a central feature or principle, some may say, of international lawmaking. That central feature is the requirement of state consent to international law. This requirement is the topic of our conference. I would like to do three things in those opening remarks. Well, four. The first one, the primary one, being, of course, to wake you up. But once this is done, I'd like to do three things. First, give you some information about the background for the conference and about some of the issues it is set to address. Second, specify the three groups of topics we will discuss and, by extension, the conference's aims. And thirdly and finally, explain how the conference will be organized and go over a few practical details. So let me start with the background and the issues. Today's conference concludes a series of lectures I gave this year at the Collège, and some of you attended them, on the public-private distinction and international law. This lecture series referred to some of the private law analogies that were prevalent in the original 17th and 18th centuries international legal arguments, and which contributed to the construction of what became known in the 19th century as public international law. One of those private law analogies was states' consent to international law, or more literally, states' consent to be bound by international law. Originally, this analogy dated back to the liberal anthropomorphic approach to interstate relations, and especially to the understanding of international treaties between states as contracts. According to the analogy, and it's well known, states are pictured as consenting to international treaties that bind them, in the same way private persons consent into a contract and are bound following that exchange of consents. Later on, as epitomized by the Permanent Court of International Justice Lotus decision, state consent to international law became associated with a voluntarist approach to state sovereignty and, by extension, a voluntarist brand of legal positivism. Today, interestingly, the obligations stemming from international treaties, but also from international legal sources in general, and we'll discuss this, together with the jurisdiction of international courts and tribunals, are still predominantly considered by international lawyers as being based on state consent. This is the case in spite of the numerous normative and descriptive arguments that have been put forward over the years against the centrality of state consent in international lawmaking, especially since the second half of the 20th century. To that extent, international law differs from domestic law, where consent has long been considered irrelevant, or at least peripheral, to the obligations arising from lawmaking. In domestic law and domestic legal theory, indeed, consent is not or no longer considered a criterion of legal validity or a ground of justification of the legitimate authority of law. This, by contrast, to consent's relevance in domestic, private, or criminal law, where consent to obligations or at least liability arising from contracting or promising have been pervasive in all private relations. Of course, state consent to be bound by international law is an old chestnut in international legal theory. And its central role in international law has been heavily criticized, as we all know. Despite many of its original conceptual and normative faults, however, consent is one of those chestnuts that still puzzles or fascinates many international lawyers today. And it has become the object of a renewed legal philosophical interest as of late, with a flurry of new publications on the topic. This is partly due to the rekindling of the philosophy of international law tradition in the last 20 years or so, but also, as we will see, to the growing concerns about international law's democratic legitimacy and the protection of the equal right to self-government of the peoples of this world. Importantly, those contemporary philosophical and doctrinal debates about consent, the new ones, do not merely repeat earlier ones. They have mostly moved away from the original and often misguided identifications between consensualism and voluntarism. They have also mostly realized how consent may not, after all, be considered a criterion of international legal validity, a ground or justification for the legitimacy of international law, or a condition of state sovereignty. And luckily, finally, current discussions of consent to international law have also mostly shifted away from the later and often unhappy and very simplistic oppositions between so-called objective and subjective international law, so-called communitarian and individualistic conceptions thereof, or even between the public and the private in international law. In those oppositions, indeed, state consent was usually wrongly assimilated with and then reduced to the corner of the subjective, the individualistic, the self-interested, and the private side of international law. Besides those reunited philosophical discussions of consent, or together with those discussions, the question has also regained in relevance in the practice of international law as of late, and arguably increasingly so. Thus, and starting with the sources of international law, practitioners have now realized that the notions and types of consent and agreement have remained regrettably informal and difficult to grasp in international treaty law, and this at all stages of treaty making and interpreting. Recently, as we will see, this has revived the discussion around the differences between treaties, interstate contracts, and other international, albeit non-legal, agreements, such as the increasingly common political commitments among states. New consensual techniques are also being experimented in multilateral treaty-making processes, such as international environmental law treaties, techniques which could be fruitfully exported into lawmaking processes pertaining to other international public goods in the future. One should also mention the place of consent in the formation of custom, giving rise to new questions about the end of consent and the legality of so-called withdrawals from customary law. Moreover, and unexpectedly, given some of the anti-consent original arguments in favor of so-called non-consensual law, the question of consent has recently resurfaced, together with other private law analogies, in debates pertaining to the sources of the normativity of international informal or soft law. The question there, then, pertains to what it is, after all, that makes that informal or soft law binding, if not consent. Turning to a second domain of the international legal practice where consent is being discussed again, international adjudication, the consensual jurisdiction of international courts and tribunal has also attracted renewed attention recently.
This is due to the assertive development of some international tribunals' case law, both on their respective consent-based jurisdiction and on consent-based sources of international law. And what we've then observed in a mirroring exercise has been certain states' withdrawal, or at least qualifications and specifications of their jurisdictional clauses. After being maybe too quickly considered as outdated, state consent to jurisdiction seems therefore to have become pivotal again to the future of international adjudication. In international responsibility law as well, consent works as a central feature of the recent practice. It works, as we all know, as an exception to responsibility. And recently, this has raised questions in the context of the consent to the use of force and liabilities related to that consent and regarding the identity of the consenting subject. Third and final domain area of the international law practice where consent is being revived at the moment, it's the context of the institutions of international law. With respect to the other institutions and states, it's now common to refer to the will or at least the consent of international organizations, even if the normative implications of that consent remain often very different from those of state consent. And one should also mention the increasing inclusion of private persons, such as NGOs, especially affected persons, organizations, in international lawmaking processes. Those NGOs and organizations of civil society are considered as participants alongside consenting states. For instance, in the so-called and very fashionable multi-stakeholders agreements. And they are included therein by emulating state consent rather than circumventing it. These recent debates about the notion and roles of consent, but also about its objects and types, and about its subjects and institutions, may be observed in all regimes of international law. It's the case in environmental law, as I mentioned, but also international human rights law, international humanitarian law, and maybe others, as we will know here, no doubt here in this conference. So let me now move to the second set of remarks I want to make this morning. The second set of remarks pertains to the topics and objectives of the conference. In order to address those various doctrinal and practical issues I've just mentioned, and as it has become customary at the chair, both international lawyers and philosophers of international law have been invited to this conference. As the cursory survey I've just made reveals, the issues raised by consent to international law are difficult. They pertain to the nature, validity, and legitimate authority of international law. They pertain to its interpretation, to the sovereignty of states, their sovereign equality, international legal personality, and international institutional representation. Those issues are not usually addressed together and in all their philosophical complexity by existing international law accounts of consent. They cannot, however, be solved in a fully informed way by legal philosophy accounts alone either. The latter tend to overgeneralize, glossing over the complexity of the practice of international lawmaking. This is why I hope, and your presence here today confirms it, that this conference will show how much both groups of scholars still have to learn from each other. So let me now say a little more about the aims of the dialogue this conference hopes to launch between legal philosophers and international lawyers, and especially about the topics we'll be discussing. You may have noticed from the program, and I hope you've picked a program outside, or maybe you had it online, you've noticed from the program that our discussion will be structured around three parts. A panel one called Notions, Types, and Roles of Consent, a panel two called Objects of Consent, and a third panel called Subjects of Consent. Those are the three groups of topics I hope we'll be able to discuss and go to the bottom of during this conference. First, the notions of consent to international law and the roles of consent in contemporary international law. Here, we'll be discussing issues such as the actual nature of consent. Is it a descriptive, a normative concept? Is it a paradigm, an axiom, a principle, or all those different things it is usually qualified of? Is it an intentional state, a pure expression, an exercise of a normative power, and so on? In terms of roles of consent, we'll be addressing the exact role of consent in relation to validity, legitimacy, sovereignty, and we'll also try to delineate consent from related notions, such as will, agreement, convention, commitment, acceptance, consensus, or participation. The second group of topics we'll be addressing is objects of consent to international law, objects of consent and types of consent. Here we'll be addressing obligations, obviously, obligations arising from different sources of international law, but also jurisdiction, and we'll be trying to delineate consent or consent-based agreements from interstate contracts or political commitments. The third group of topics the conference will address are the subjects and institutions of consent to international law. Here we'll be addressing states, of course, but also international organizations, cities, regions, and maybe civil society entities such as NGOs, which I've mentioned before, and transnational cooperation. But deep down, the question will be, who's consenting when the state or an IO is consenting? Is there people there? Are there many peoples? How do we relate institutional consent to those peoples? So this is the primary aim of the conference, addressing, going through those three sets of topics. But from a more critical perspective, a second aim of the conference, exploration of the notions and roles, objects and types, and subjects and institutions of consent to international law, is to shed light on the increasingly vexed questions of the normativity and authority of international law, qua law, and of the legitimacy of international institutions, qua institutions of law. Indeed, even if the anthropomorphism and private law analogies age is long past in international law, and even if legal positivism is no longer wedded to voluntarism, consensualism may still have a private law flavor. If unattended, and the present conference secondary aim is precisely to attend to this, if unattended, consent's reemergence in practice may strengthen the ongoing process of privatization of public international law. How may a legal order that began by treating public institutions like states, by analogy to private persons from the 17th to the 19th centuries, now be expected to resist to the treatment of private persons by analogy to public institutions? How can such a legal order be expected to treat private persons' consent differently from that of states? It is, after all, and for instance, in a private law guise that consent has reemerged in discussions pertaining to the normativity of international informal and soft law lately. Those discussions of the role of consent thereby contribute to questioning the specificity and exclusivity of the consent of states, qua public, and sovereign institutions representing their peoples in international lawmaking. In those new informal law frameworks, indeed, states are simply assimilated to other actors, both public and private, in their right to consent. And this time around, states do not benefit from an international legal framework that could protect weaker states from stronger ones, or protect states' peoples from other more powerful stakeholders. The erosion of the right not to consent to soft law of certain states, small states, weak states, epitomizes the problem. And the same may be argued about the personification of IOs in the debates pertaining to their autonomous will or consent in international treaty making or customary practice. This focus on IO's legal personality has indeed kept international lawyers from addressing the far more pressing institutional questions of the multiple representation of the same peoples by those IOs and member states, and what that multiple representation of the same peoples should mean in terms of political equality, public representation, and institutional participation in international lawmaking. So in fact, what one may coin the private return of consent in international law also implies is that the alleged rise of the so-called non-consensual international law, far from signaling the demise of consent, may actually only have marked the demise of states' consent, states and other public institutions' consent in international lawmaking. Keeping consent in place while displacing states, the so-called non-consensual international law has in fact contributed to a process of privatization and contractualization of international lawmaking already at play. And this process was actually facilitated by the dubious reduction in international law scholarship, which I did mention before, of state consent to a purely subjective, individualistic, self-interested, and private posture, and by the promotion instead of a so-called objective, collective, communitarian, and public conception of international law that was meant to be severed from state consent rather than constructed around it. And in turn, this has left this new process of regulation of alleged international public goods entirely into the hands of private actors, insufficiently institutionalized and uncontrolled trustees, unchecked international judges, or even worse, a couple of powerful states using the now largely inegalitarian and privatized institutional structures of IOs and various soft law mechanisms to rule over weaker ones. Of course, I know what you'll say. We all know from the ticking clock of climate change and the many other public goods in urgent need of identification, specification, and protection by international law that international lawmaking is often paralyzed by disagreements among states. It's paralyzed by the withholding of some states' consent. And this is why I started my opening remarks this morning referring to divisio. But I beg to differ with what is often argued against state consent in international treaty making or in international organizations. Indeed, while it is true that giving states a veto or at least refusal rights in international lawmaking may be part of the problem, the equal consent of states' people also has to be part of the solution. This is at least provided international law is to be the kind of public, hard, and representative law we may all deem legitimate democratically. So, breaking away from the pragmatic resignation that often prevails among international law scholars on the question of state consent, it is time international lawyers revise international institutions and procedures so as to enforce a new, more democratic conception of state consent. A conception that enables states, but also arguably other public institutions, as we will see, to represent all peoples and their public interests effectively in international lawmaking. Such an account of democratic consent, state consent, would not only fit and justify the contemporary practice of the formal sources of international law, where consent, as I said before, does retain a central, albeit changing, role. But with its revised understanding, justification, and limits, such a new account of state consent may also contribute to bringing states and other public institutions back to those formal sources of international law in the future and away from soft law making processes, to the benefit of domestic democracy and accountability of international law to all peoples. This, at least, is the secondary, more critical aim of our conference. So let me close those introductory remarks by making a third set of comments on the organization and the format of a conference. So in order to address the three sets of topics that I identified before, so notions and types, notions and roles, objects and types, and subjects and institutions of consent, a conference is organized around three thematic panels. Of course, as we all know, and participants in the room know as well, having read the papers, there may and will be overlaps between some of the three panels' papers. It's difficult to classify any given argument about consent to international law as pertaining only to its nature, only to its objects and types, or only to its subjects and institutions. But as you will see listening to our speakers, we've tried as much as possible to contain the arguments within those three boxes. Each panel comprises four papers and presentations. We've lost one paper tomorrow on Friday morning's panel. Georg Nolte conveys his regrets. So we'll start at 10 instead of 9:30. But otherwise, each panel contains four paper. And on each panel, you have a good mix, at least we've tried, of international lawyers and philosophers of international law, liaising and talking to one another about the most pressing questions of consent in international law. At the end of each of our panels, an experienced commentator will react to the four papers. Those comments will bring a fifth perspective, but will also illuminate some of the common threads in the papers commented. In terms of discussions, we'll hold a one-hour discussion at the end of each panel. Once the commentator has delivered its comment, we will open first a discussion among panelists, and then among speakers, and finally with the audience. For the first time, I've also decided to innovate with the general conclusions at the end of the conference, in the sense that I've been lucky enough to convince Yannick Radi to deliver general conclusions on Friday afternoon. But they won't be ordinary general conclusions, no pressure, Yannick. There will be general conclusions that will basically open a conversation. And I hope we will then be able, for an hour or two, to discuss the general conclusions and to get back to some of the issues addressed in the course of the 2 days. So stay tuned. The discussion will carry on until the very, very end of the conference. So before turning to the first panel, please allow me to introduce my assistants, Ms. Sylvie Sportouche, who I don't think is in the room, but you've met her at the entrance earlier, and Ms. Mathilde Montaubin, who's here, and to thank them warmly for everything they did to prepare this conference. They will be actively assisting you during those 2 days, so if you have any questions, please do not hesitate to contact them. And one last recommendation for the speakers before giving the floor to Jean Despremont, who will chair the first panel. Please make sure you respect the time allocated to your presentations and comments. This is the price to pay for those long discussions we will have at the end of each panel. Let me thank you all for being here, the speakers, obviously, who've traveled and worked so hard to be here today, but also everyone in the audience. I look forward to meeting you, listening to you, and thank you for producing such wonderful papers simply being here. I certainly look forward very much to this conference, and I wish you all an enjoyable 2 days. Thank you.